The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 10 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And we return one more time to the May 2021 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. And because it's the last reading of the month, I'm going to be reading the Decade article. We're into the 1970s, the decade of disruption. We have a couple of men in gray suits looking at each other here on the cover. It says Governor James E. Holzhauser, Jr., and his lieutenant governor and later successor, James B. Hunt, Jr., came from different political parties. But they found common ground and worked together. A political sea change. The election of two young politicians to the state's top offices, including the first Republican governor in generations, signals new ideas on the horizon. Written, as always, by Philip Gerard. There's a picture here of a man and woman at a podium with the great seal of the state of North Carolina on the front, and it says, Jim Holzhauser became governor in 1973. Standing alongside him for his inauguration was his wife, Patricia. It looks like a high school kid. I got to tell you, this talk about a young-looking politician. It's amazing. But it's back in 1973, and his wife's hairdo is a classic from the 60s and early 70s. It's great big bouffant style hair, and she has a white fur coat on and a big smile on her face, but he looks like a very young man, like he might be attending his high school graduation. In 1972, two young, energetic politicians from opposing parties shake up the political scene. James E. Holzhauser, Jr., the 38-year-old chairman of the state Republican Party, hails from Boone. He's served four terms in the State House of Representatives and now sets his sights on the governorship. North Carolina has not elected a Republican governor in the 20th century, but Holzhauser wins with 51% of the vote, the youngest governor in state history. James B. Hunt, Jr., the 35-year-old son of a farmer in Wilson County, aims for lieutenant governor, a post that in North Carolina carries significant legislative power. Hunt entered politics as a college student. When Terry Sanford ran for governor, he explains, I was in graduate school, I had been student body president in North Carolina State, and he asked me to go out and form students for Sanford on every college campus in North Carolina, and I did. We helped him get elected. Hunt, a Democrat, is also victorious. And Democrats retain control of the legislature, many voters obviously splitting their tickets. People were electing folks they thought would be the best leaders from both parties, Hunt explains. Now the work begins. At the time, North Carolina has one of the most powerful lieutenant governor's offices in the country, Hunt says. The lieutenant governor appointed committees, referred bills, and, of course, presided over and sometimes called it ran the Senate. Holzhauser's election comes on the crest of a breaking wave. The battle for racial equality has roiled state politics since the Civil War. For the generation following the 1870 impeachment of Governor William Woods Holden for his campaign against the Ku Klux Klan, white supremacist Democrats largely controlled North Carolina politics. After 1877, no Republican held the governorship until an increased turnout by Republicans, including many black voters, gave the contentious 1896 election to Daniel Russell. But a new white supremacist backlash followed, culminating in an 1898 racial massacre and coup against the fusionist government of Wilmington Russell. Russell would be the last Republican governor until 1973. During the 1972 election, a sea change that had been building since Brown versus Board of Education came to a head. The Democrats, increasingly the champions of civil rights under Presidents John F. Kennedy and Lyndon B. Johnson, have been causing disaffection among many white voters. In 1968, Richard Nixon defeated Hubert Humphrey on the platform of Law and Order, a Southern strategy designed to win over white voters in the states of the old Confederacy. In 1972, the defection of white voters from the Democratic Party is massive. Nixon sweeps the South, taking North Carolina by a margin of more than 40 points. On his coattails, he carries into office a freshman senator known for his far-right conservative views, a former TV broadcaster and program director named Jesse A. Helms, Jr. Helms started honing his method of political attack as far back as 1958. As a Democratic city councilman in Raleigh, he complained to the city manager that the list of speakers at the Institute of Religion included avowed liberal Hubert Humphrey, labor organizer Victor Reuther, and Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Helms wrote, "It would be most unfortunate if any untoward incident should occur during the visits." The Raleigh News and Observer called him out on his veiled threat, accusing Helms of pious incitement. He was not just conservative, he was also reactionary, and he did not have a tolerant view toward African Americans, Hunt says of Helms. His effect was not to pull people together and get them to cooperate, but to exploit differences, especially between races and on other issues, too. But Holzhauser is a progressive with laudable goals. For too long, many people in our state have been on the outside looking in, he announces at his inauguration. We've got to have more involvement of the black community, of the Indians, of young people, and of women. He appoints a special assistant for minority affairs and the first woman to serve in the executive cabinet. His first executive order shows his conservative side, establishing the Governor's Efficiency Study Commission, which he describes in a televised address at the end of his term. We asked our business community leaders in North Carolina to come in and take a hard look at state government and recommend changes that would save money without hurting programs, he tells viewers. Of almost 700 committee recommendations, Holzhauser's administration adopts nearly 600. Prior to the election, Hunt fully supported the Democratic ticket, including his friend and gubernatorial candidate, Hargrove Skipper Bowles, Jr. But afterwards, Holzhauser and Hunt form a productive partnership that warms into a lifelong friendship. One shared passion is education. Part of Holzhauser's platform was putting public school kindergartens in North Carolina. Hunt says, full-day kindergarten was part of my platform when I ran for lieutenant governor for the same year. We worked together to put that in. That was a time of progress, when we found common things between us, and we both carried our parties along, and the state benefited. By the end of Holzhauser's term, only one is allowed by law. The kindergarten program has grown from about 3,400 children to more than 80,000. Roads and bridges across the state have been vastly improved. The 16 campuses of the university system consolidated. Community colleges strengthened and rural health clinics established in areas of most need. The economy is booming, and more land has been brought into the state park system than under all previous governors combined. But for all of the administration's concrete accomplishments, in his farewell address, Holzhauser emphasizes the power of ineffable virtues. There's another responsibility for people in government today that has to do with those two important words, care and trust, he reminds his listeners. And as I close these 4 years, I want to urge you most of all to have faith in our system of government. And yes, to have faith in government and those who care enough to offer themselves for public office and get the title of politician. The great, great majority of those I've met, Democrats and Republicans alike, are honest, well-meaning, and hardworking. Holzhauser gracefully exits to practice law in Southern Pines and Boone, and for most of the next four decades, he continues to work closely with his friend and colleague Hunt on a variety of issues, especially education. Turnabout comes in the next election cycle. Jim Hunt is now governor. In his first year, he initiates North Carolina Tomorrow, a statewide conference augmented by meetings in all 100 counties. Some 100,000 questionnaires echo the priorities of citizens. Economic growth that preserves the character of communities and programs to better the lives and prospects of children. With his own expansive agenda on education, economic development, the environment, and a host of other concerns, Hunt feels hamstrung by the statutory single-term limit. By now, most states allow consecutive terms for governor. I proposed that North Carolina amend the Constitution to permit succession for one term, he says, and then I had my political organization go out and work very hard to pass it. It's a tough sell, requiring a constitutional amendment with the approval of both houses of the legislature and a popular vote. Many conservatives, including Helms, actively oppose the referendum, but it passes. And now the office of governor takes on a different character. It means the governor can have a long-term view, and possibly a longer time, to carry through the program. But it also means that the governor is going to be more apt to get support from the legislature. Hunt explains, it made a real difference and still does. It doesn't guarantee anything, but it means a greater possibility of having progress. Hunt wins a second term, and after a hiatus, returns for two more terms, making his mark as perhaps the most effective governor in modern times, his main focus never veering from education. Those are big times, he recalls. We got great things done during the years, despite the divisive politics of Helms, with whom he later worked on some economic initiatives. He retains respect for the Republicans with whom he served, especially Holthouser. North Carolina has primarily gone along with its better angels, Hunt says, and Jim Holthouser was one of them. Coming next month, saving our treasured coast. You are listening to Our State Magazine in the North Carolina Reading Service. Comments, questions, call 919-832-5138. I'm going to read an article on Southport because I have been there and I have a couple of friends who live there, and it's the featured article this month. But I am struck by the full-page advertisement just to the left of the article. It says, Room to Roam. Enjoy a family-friendly outdoor experience this spring. Check out www.nczoo.org to plan your visit. It is a picture of a beautiful African elephant. I had the privilege of going on a safari in Africa a few years ago. Not the type where you shoot animals, you shoot them with your camera. And I have memorable pictures like this one. The animal has got his trunk up in the air, and he looks like he's making a big elephant noise and saying, don't come any closer, please. But this one was probably taken at the North Carolina Zoo, a great place to visit. So here we are at Southport, at the mouth of the Cape Fear River. This coastal town's colorful cottages and majestic live oaks have made it a picturesque setting for many feature films written by Katie King. Caption on the page says, after a day of sailing or fishing, dock your boat next to Fishy Cafe and grab a bite to eat right on the intracoastal waterway. I would remind you that the intracoastal waterway, it runs from, I'm going to say, Delaware down to Florida, and it's how you can take a boat and travel without going on the open ocean, at least for any significant portion. It's behind banks and things like that. You get a little protection. So this town is on the intracoastal waterway. We see some docks with there's a big sailboat here and a couple of power boats. And then we see this part of the sign on the roof of Fishy Cafe. And there's a three-story house and several two-story homes just behind it. And in the distance, a water tower. At their gallery in Southport, Ricky and Debbie Evans showcase the beauty of their coastal town. All of the artists featured in the shop live within 60 miles, and many pieces reflect the landscapes, seascapes, and colorful culture of the area. It seems like Southport attracts that talent in people. Debbie says. With the retirement communities here, there are so many people who have worked in other areas and always wanted to pursue their artistic careers, and they just found the perfect spot, like we did, to let that grow. Debbie was working for a frame shop in Wilmington when she was hired by Ricky, a watercolorist and photographer, to help him in his galleries in Laurinburg and Southport. Then, Debbie says with a laugh, he decided it was going to be cheaper if he married me than to have me as an employee. The two tied the knot at Southport in 2000 and never looked back. One of the things we loved about the town was its location right here on the water, right next to the ocean, Debbie says. We've got all kinds of water surrounding us, the beautiful oak trees, the old homes. It's just a quaint place, yet it's a thriving place. And the rest of this article is actually little insets about various places. So the first one says, shop, Ricky Evans Gallery. Just two blocks from the waterfront, the Evanses have made their home in this cozy cottage where they sell Ricky's paintings, photography, and pen and ink drawings, plus pottery, copperwork, jewelry, and other pieces by area artists. We're a true mom-and-pop operation here, Debbie says. We work downstairs and live upstairs. Franklin Square Gallery. The Evanses partnered with this artist co-op to start Southport's first Friday gallery walk. They maintain an old historic building, and they renovated it and brought it up to date so everyone can see it as well as enjoy the artwork, Debbie says. It's a very nice gallery, and we're proud to be one of their partners. A little picture here of the two-story house. It has a wide porch running around the two sides of the house that we see. An American flag and another flag, which might be the North Carolina flag. Can't really tell the way it's hanging. There are some artwork hanging by the front door, and there's a piece of artwork on its, it's set on the floor, but it's about 3 feet tall and 6 inches wide, and it looks like it might be a long shot of a lighthouse at the very top of it. There's a beautiful white picket fence coming around the walkway and the sidewalk, and another painting is on a stand exhibited in the front yard. And then we have Potter's Seafood Market. Fifth generation's fisherman Royce Potter's family has been providing the fresh catch of the day for folks at Southport since 1899. We go down and get fresh shrimp off the boat as well as grouper and oysters, Debbie says. They have all kinds of goodies in there, depending on the season. And Ocean Outfitters. It started as a little cinder block building right outside of town, and they moved downtown and have about a third of a block now, Debbie says. They sell outdoor clothing, shoes, and gear that Debbie says is right on the cutting edge of all the new stuff that the young folks like, and us old folks, too. So we see Potter's Seafood Market on the sign here, wholesale retail. It's a yellow clapboard building with a rolling wide white door in the front. That is, it's hung on a track and can be pulled closed with runners along that track. And there's a window there and, something about parking for Potter's seafood only. I guess that's a parking space. We can't quite see it. It's right on the water, so there's a dock, and then there's a fishing boat right on the other side, and lots of colorful buoys hanging from a line that is stretched from the shop all the way down to the other end of the dock. Wild by Nature, Robin Weir's Flower Shop is one of the most colorful little buildings in town, Debbie says, both inside and out. Her shop has got every color in the world on the outside, and it is so pretty. Weir has been designing floral arrangements for more than 30 years, and she hosts classes to share her knowledge. We have here on the yellow wall of the building, she has four flowering plants in various stages of being open. There's a fifth one at the bottom, but it isn't open at all, and then the others are in various stages of emerging. Beautiful red color. And then stay, the Bell Clemens House Bed and Breakfast. This renovated Civil War era house welcomes guests to sit in rocking chairs on one of its three porches and relax in one of three guest rooms. I like seeing people who renovate these old homes and turn them into something that people can enjoy, Debbie says. All we see is the porch here. It has a blue floor, and a darker blue set of rockers here. I guess you'd call them Appalachian style rockers, and some hanging plants, and then the street beyond. We're still downtown. Eat at the Blue Cow Grill. Blue Cow has become one of my favorite places to eat, Debbie says. Their burgers are out of this world, and my husband always gets the pork rinds. They're always alternating their menu a little bit to suit different tastes, and they do a good job of it. And for dessert, Flava's ice cream. Debbie says that almost everybody who comes to town stops here for both traditional and adventurous flavors. She loves Death by Chocolate. In addition to Blue Bunny, they carry Mayola ice cream, which was founded in New Bern and is sourced from North Carolina dairy farmers. Now, this is a little girl with a very big waffle cup. And it looks like she's got pistachio at the bottom and strawberry on the top of it. And how about that Fishy Fishy Cafe? This casual seafood spot is right on the water, drawing visitors who come by boat as well as by car or on foot for the bacon-wrapped stuffed shrimp, grilled tuna, and lump crab cakes from North Carolina. Everything I've ever had there is good, Debbie says. The fish is fresh off the boat. You can't get much closer than when the boat's next door. Provision Company, another Southport standby for locals and visitors. This waterfront restaurant serves up steamed seafood, salads, sandwiches, and pies. You just stand by the water and enjoy the view and linger over the food, Debbie says. All the locals go there at least once a week to meet and greet and just enjoy life. It's a happy place. Play. North Carolina Maritime Museum at Southport. Situated where the Cape Fear River, the Intracoastal Waterway, and the Atlantic Ocean meet, the Maritime Museum traces the history of the region through exhibits on local fisheries, shipwrecks, hurricanes, and military conflicts. The Maritime Museum is something I think the whole community is proud of, Debbie says. Keziah Park. The centerpiece of this small downtown park is the Indian Trail tree, estimated to be about 800 years old. Legend has it that when the tree was a sapling, the Indians bent it, and it took root in the ground again. So it's formed in the shape of an upside-down U, Debbie says. It marked their trails down to the fishing spots. It's a neat place to go, and think about how old this area really is. Small town on the big screen. Southport's colorful setting on the North Carolina coast has attracted producers of many movies and TV shows. Here are just a few of the locations that have helped make a name for Southport in Hollywood. American Fish Company. This waterfront bar was Ivan's Fish Shack in the movie Safe Haven, known as the best place to watch the sunset in Southport. It also has appeared in Weekend at Bernie's, I Know What You Did Last Summer, and The Three Lives of Karen. Old Smithfield Burying Ground, shaded by giant live oaks, this mid-1700 cemetery predates the town and serves as a backdrop in scenes from Crimes of the Heart, A Walk to Remember, Matlock Under the Dome, and more. Trinity United Methodist Church. This simple white church was built in 1890 and features a beautiful wooden interior. In A Walk to Remember, Jamie's father was the reverend at this church, which has made appearances in several TV shows and movies. And finally, Amuzu Theater. Built in 1918, this historic theater has served as a cinema and a live theater venue. It has been on the big screen in Crimes of the Heart, I Know What You Did Last Summer, and The Secret Lives of Bees. The only one that is pictured here is the American Fish Company. It's a red shack on a dock. It looks like a brand new dock. It sticks out over the water, so it's a nice place to stand and enjoy watching the surf and maybe the people that are swimming out there. The shack itself is bright red with a sort of a silvery metal roof and a sign that says American Fish Company. And now, quick bite in Blowing Rock, sandwiches by the scoop. The Swatoga County Dessert Shop in a camper makes local ice cream and homemade cookies taste even sweeter. How? By serving them together. Underneath a canopy of crisscrossing string lights, customers stand in line outside a vintage camper adorned with a Carolina blue deer head, eagerly awaiting a scoop of ice cream sandwiched between two scratch-made cookies. At Blue Deer, there are plenty of combinations to choose from. Perhaps a cool dollop of lemon crunch ice cream between two graham cracker cookies, or a pair of warm double chocolate cookies with strawberry ice cream, to name just two. High school sweethearts and Watoga County natives Austin and Callie Northern opened the Blue Deer Camper in Blowing Rock in May 2018 to offer folks a special dessert experience in a celebratory atmosphere. In June 2020, the husband and wife team opened a storefront on King Street in Boone, and they'll open another on Main Street in Blowing Rock this summer. And in an effort to highlight other local businesses, they proudly use Homeland Creamery ice cream from Guilford County as a standalone serving or with their tried and true cookies. Blue Deer Camper is on U.S. Highway 321 South in Blowing Rock. They have a website, despite the fact they're only a camper, bluedeercookies.com. And how about cider a la Blue Ridge? Surrounded by rolling acres of blossoming European apple trees, a cidery in rural Henderson County brings a taste of northern France to North Carolina. Appalachian Ridge Artisan Hard Cidery's warm, inviting tasting room transports customers to a different time and place, say a rustic tavern in pastoral Normandy, France. Inside the 1940s European-style barn, original rough-hewn wood extends from floor to ceiling, and the stall doors now crown metal tables. The only new fixtures are the lighting and a distressed copper top bar. The three-year-old cidery sits on 100 acres of owner Alan Ward's centuries-old family land. The Appalachian Ridge produces five Normandy-style ciders that range from dry to semi-sweet. Crisp and effervescent, the beverages are the product of a complex melding of French and other European apple varieties with names like Binet Rouge and Belle de Boscoupe. The orchard grows 42 apple varieties used to make the ciders, 14 of which aren't grown anywhere else in the county. Ward has been operating St. Paul Mountain Vineyard nearby since 2008. His foray into cider isn't a leap, though, because as he explains, cider is a wine in that it is fermented fruit juice. And the bottled ciders, which are named for nearby mountains, deliver a complexity that's on par with fine wine. Appalachian Ridge Artisan Hard Cidery, Chestnut Gap Road, Henderson, stpaulfarms.com. And that, my friends, is all the time we have for today's episode of Our State Magazine. Hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving our community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org, and on iTunes. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.